In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, author Rochelle Chase has come up with a creative new idea for bringing the history of Buxton, Iowa to life, and she's founded a new history nonprofit called Uniting Through History. I will talk with her. But first, it was March of 1857. Iowans had endured a long, cold, harsh winter, and as things were beginning to thaw, there was violence on the frontier. Ink Paduta and his band of Wapakute Dakota attacked. At least 39 white settlers, men, women, and children, died in what has been known as the Spirit Lake Massacre. Four women were taken captive, including young Abby Gardner, who later wrote about her ordeal. And for generations, we've been telling and teaching this story in a very one-sided way. A new graphic novel by Cedar Falls artist Gary Kelly called Moon of the Snowblind illuminates both sides of this tragic event and gives all of us a fuller understanding of our history. Gary is with me on the line. Hello, Gary.
Hey, Charity. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here. And I was just reflecting this morning when I was in junior high, I did a research project on what we called the Spirit Lake Massacre. And if only I had had your book and the other work of historians that has come out since then to help me really understand what happened, that would have been a much fuller, richer, and more honest experience. But I'm glad that this is here now. Gary, you grew up in northern Iowa. Tell me what your relationship was as a child to hearing about the Spirit Lake Massacre.
Well, yeah, I mostly grew up in Algona, Iowa, Kossuth County. Actually, junior high in Los Angeles, but I don't really know why. But as a kid, if I went to a Western movie, I wanted the Indians to win, you know, not the Cowboys. And I grew up with a real intense, I guess, interest and passion for Native American culture and history. My uncle, I actually dedicated the book to my late uncle Gene Kelly, and he had a book on his bookshelf. He also taught me how to draw when I was a little kid, but he had a book on his bookshelf called The Spirit Lake Massacre. That was the Abby Gardner autobiography, and I happened to get kind of hooked on that book, and then of course it went on the shelf. I inherited it, and it went on the shelf for a long time. But I've been working on this graphic novel for probably the last 6 or 8 years, off and on, and that's when the book came back in right in front of me, and I wanted to tell that story from actually, Charity. The key page for me at the end of planning or designing the book was the front page inside. I put two faces on that page and the words "two sides to every story." And that's the way I wanted to tell it.
Telling both sides to this story, I feel, really deepens the tragedy, deepens the pain of this story. Gary, what was it that made you start looking at this story again 6 or 8 years ago? I mean, this has been a project you've been working on for a long time, and obviously something that's been very important to you. Do you remember, was there a moment that made you think, you know what, I need to tell this story in a different way?
Well, not really, Charity. It had always been in the back of my mind. And I had played around with, I was never a professional graphic novelist or anything like that. I've been an illustrator and an artist for years, but I had started other graphic novels just because I was sometimes intrigued by trying to do them in a little different way, or kind of quality or something. And then the Spirit Lake story just kind of reached out to me as the perfect story to tell as a graphic novel. And I didn't realize it would be as popular as what it's sounding like it's going to be, but I had to get it finished. I'd started other graphic novels, other stories, and maybe get 8 or 10 pages in and lose interest, and then move on to another project, another assignment. But I'm amazed I finished this book, 184 pages, about probably 280 drawings.
How did you do your research for the book?
As an illustrator and a painter and artist, I love the research part of a project most of the time. And I just would keep notes, and I did most all of it either at the library or at bookstores, and reading a lot. In the book itself, I have a list of all the books that I actually was connected to, the sources. It's on the back page of the book. But, I think it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, probably about a dozen different books. But the first one was, it's reading the books, Charity, and most of these books are none of these books are really picture books. And so that's a good thing for me. I, as an artist and an illustrator, I like to get an assignment that I have to read, whatever it is, news or classic literature or whatever, and then figure out my way to tell that story visually. And that was what addicted me to Spirit Lake, for sure.
You lived with this story for so long as you worked on this project. Can you tell me a little bit about how that worked for you? I mean, is this something where you would sit down and work for a while and then leave it alone, or is this something that was always sort of with you?
Actually, both. Mentally, it was always with me in my mind. But I, as an illustrator, you're with a fair number of assignments coming and going. You can't say my favorite book publisher, Creative Editions, for example. I've done a bunch of picture books for them, story books. If they gave me an assignment and a deadline, that would be the top of my list. If I do a page or a spot illustration for the New Yorker magazine, that would have to come and go, as Spirit Lake sits on the shelf. It's a story that I just kept thinking about and realizing that, okay, I cannot let this go. I have to finish this. This is really important to me, and I want to tell it in my own words and my own pictures and from my point of view. And I have to add, too, Charity, that I was delighted. I have a connection with Art Cullen in Storm Lake, the Pulitzer Prize-winning editor. And I just asked him to write a note, on the back of my book, on the back cover of my book. And I have to admit that he and I are on the same page, and I was very proud and happy and that I could get him to endorse the book. I didn't want to go to a list of endorsers. I just wanted Art to say something about it for me.
Tell me a little bit about how you chose to illustrate this story. It's all in black and white and pen and ink drawings. What did you want to capture with your artwork?
Well, that's a good question. as an illustrator and a painter and a drawer, for a long time now. It's really, it's for me, it's about the point of view, the composition, and a composition always of an image always has to, of course, deal with the framework, you know, the where it's cropped on all four sides, and what where you're looking at somebody's face or a hand or a landscape or a wildlife or whatever, and so that's, I think, a big reason why I stuck with it, because when I get an assignment, I don't want to. I want to do it in, from maybe a slightly unique point of view. I want to tell the story visually. That might have words with it, of course, but I want to tell it visually from an interesting point of view. I don't want to just graphic novels that I own or that I've looked at it that I see. A lot of them are just panel after panel after panel after panel of people talking back and forth to each other. You know, just faces and bodies, and I can't do it that way. I need to create each panel as if I was going to do a large painting of it someday. That's why it took so long, Charity.
We are going to bring a historian into the conversation here in just a moment, Gary, right after the break. But now that this is out in the world, 164 years after these tragic events, what do you hope people take away from reading your graphic novel?
Well, as a Midwestern kid, you know, growing up, I think a lot of us had heard, like a lot of us, I had definitely heard of the story of Spirit Lake, but I was, like I said earlier, a little bit ago, I was always interested in both sides of the story, and so that's the most important thing for me. It's doing my homework, and then it's breaking it down into interesting images of a very, like I said a couple minutes ago, I want a very wide variety of images, a wide variety of points of view of each image, and so that's a big part of the challenge that kept me addicted to the story.
Well, Gary, we have to take a short break here.
Okay.
We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Gary Kelly about his new graphic novel. It's called Moon of the Snowblind, and it tells the story of a tragedy at Spirit Lake.
Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up later this hour, I'll talk with Rochelle Chase. She has come up with a creative new idea for bringing the history of Buxton, Iowa to life through a contest. She's also founded a new history nonprofit called Uniting Through History. Right now, we're talking about the incident at Spirit Lake that we've been calling for generations the Spirit Lake Massacre. It happened in March of 1857, and it's told now in a new way in the graphic novel by Gary Kelly, Moon of the Snowblind. He is committed to telling both sides of this tragic story, and there's so much pain, so much loss on both sides of this tragic story. Gary Kelly is here with me now, and I also want to bring historian Kevin Mason into the conversation. He's assistant professor of history at Waldorf University in Forest City, and he's researched the history of the Dakota in Iowa and Inkpaduta in particular. Hello, Kevin.
Good morning, Charity.
Thanks
for having me on.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. And I was talking to Gary earlier about how this is a story that really captivated him as a boy growing up in Iowa. It's a story that captivated me growing up in Iowa. What was your first encounter with stories of what we called the Spirit Lake Massacre?
I would think very similar. Usually Iowa history is taught during eighth grade as a part of the core curriculum. And I remember kind of glancing off it there. As Gary mentioned, always I've also really always been really interested in indigenous topics and something that I've always found fascinating. And then also just as an Iowan, I've always just been somebody that's kind of obsessed with our shared past. So this was one of the notable things that's always stood out to me.
When I was taught about this, as I mentioned, this was a very one-sided tale. And the history of the Spirit Lake Massacre, as I was taught, started on March 8th in 1857. But the story, what really happened, really starts before that. Kevin, take us a little bit back in time and give us some of the background that led to this tragedy.
So I think one of the things we think Peduta we can see is he's incredibly representative over the course of his lifetime. He's born sometime before 1815, after 1800, into the Dakota people, the Wapakute in particular. And he's going to kind of grow up in this era where, as a child, he's taught traditional ways of life and how to exist in this incredibly difficult environment that we all call home here in Iowa. And he's also there and witnessing the entire kind of incredible change that's going to happen to the natural environment in Iowa, both in terms of he's alive at the time of the 1805 Pike Treaty, the first Ocheti-Sakowin or Dakota Sioux treaty with the United States government, and then all the way through all of these different changes that are going to come to bear. And that's one of the things I love that Gary brought into his book. This idea that population change is one of the things I also looked at significantly in this story. And we can see Ink Peduta trying to navigate these circumstances in a variety of different ways. He's going to, after the murder of Cento Minaduta in the early 1850s, he tries to utilize the American justice system. We see the Wapakute testing treaty provisions after the 1825 treaty at Prairie du Chien and coming into a realization that the United States government isn't going to adequately project power during that time period in a way that's going to allow them to enforce treaties. And you can just kind of see this really nuanced story developing, both in terms of political history, but then also as an environmental historian, something I was really interested in is how we're seeing animal change and we're seeing plant life change and how people eat radically changing over the course of this time period as we kind of lead up to this event. And you can see life getting more and more difficult for the Dakota in a really quantitative way. And that's what I've really tried to do in my research the past five or so years.
Well, and Gary, you also bring out in your book the same thing that, of course, Kevin is talking about here. But one of the things that I think it's so important to understand is that the bison that, of course, so many indigenous people depended on for their livelihood and for, you know, not just their meat, but for so many important elements of those animals. The bison were exterminated by the United States. This was a plan to take away the livelihood of indigenous people. And Gary, I think you did a really beautiful job bringing that important element of this out in your story. I mean, the people were starving because we were taking away the way that they could live and eat, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there were so many things like that happening. And what I wanted to tell with the story, both sides, I mean, obviously it was very tough on Abby Gardner, and of course she lost her family. But the main thing I wanted the equal thing I wanted to talk about with the pictures and the words is just the fact that it was not easy for Ink Peduta and his people to be living there either. And for me, I wanted to go into the personal that personal culture of theirs a little bit. Another thing that kind of popped up that I hadn't really realized, and it's part of the story now for me, is the little chapter in the middle of the book called Smithland, Iowa. It's about, I don't know, four or five pages probably, but Smithland is down south on the Little Sioux River, just southeast of Sioux City. And when I, doing all my research, when I realized what happened in Smithland, the a few months before Spirit Lake, I thought this has to be part of the story. And so I drove all the way out there. I wanted to see where, I'd never heard of Smithland, Iowa, to tell you the truth. It's a very small town. And I drove all the way out there in the fall and I wanted to see what the hills were like and how where it was related to the river and all the visual things that because I wanted about 4 or 5 pages of Smithland in my story. And what happened in Smithland is that Inkpa Duda and his people oftentimes would spend their winters there on the edge of the settlement. And they had a relationship with the settlers for the most part. I mean, they weren't there to hurt each other, to take it over. But there was a winter where it got really nasty, and it went the wrong direction. And so that was the winter of Spirit Lake, actually. I'd never realized it till I started getting deeper into my homework. But Inkpa Duda and his people started that winter in Smithland. And then they were driven out of there, the place that they'd gone for every winter normally. They were driven out of Smithland because of some military guy that showed up from somewhere else. And they went up to Spirit Lake, and that's what happened.
Well, and I am struck by the history that you share, Gary, and by the research that you've done, Kevin. Inkpa Duda and his people were so much more mobile than the so-called settlers at the time. They were traveling through a lot of places, and they were migratory. They went to different parts of the country for different parts of the year, but then they were also being forced off of their ancestral lands by this march of settlers as they moved west. Kevin, is there anything you want to add to what Gary was saying about what happened at Smithland?
So one of the things that I worked really hard to do in my research was kind of define where we could, through different sources, both Dakota-oriented sources, but then also through military records, through other accounts that are left behind by American settlers, where we could see Inkpa Duda in Iowa during the 1850s. And we see him stretching, as Gary noted. He's down virtually every winter in the run-up to the eventual attack on Spirit Lake, staying on the property of a settler who has a very positive relationship with. And that gentleman actually moved to Sioux City that winter preceding that. And we can kind of see the Dakota moving here and there. And one of the things we often cast Inkpa Duda as this renegade, but in reality, he's still visiting other Dakota when after the attack, he goes out and lives with other parts of the Ocheti-Sakowin further into the Dakotas. And one of the things that I think about when we talk about him as a renegade is he's kind of just a renegade from this American perspective. And as he's kind of making his way through this environment, we see him going to different places. One of the things they're doing is the Dakota had an adaptable band structure where they're able to tax the natural environment less during difficult parts of the year. So you were talking about bison. We see a huge decline in bison during that time period, but elk and deer are incredibly important to the Dakota in the run-up in the kind of 1840s, 1850s. And the harsh conditions of the winter paired with this increased settlement to provide these really desperate circumstances. Also at Smithland, we see some other environmental factors coming into play. A prairie fire that's set by some of the settlers in the fall gets out of control, burns an entire field that's going to be used for hay during the winter, which is going to further exacerbate problems within the settler community feeding themselves. And as the Dakota show up in this winter, that if you go back and really quantify it, is one of the worst we've ever had on record, we can see the Dakota arriving after the first snowstorm of the year, and things are just immediately incredibly tense. There's a series of incidents that precede the eventual kind of militia coming together to evict them. And then you think about, when we talk about this as a pain and loss story and a story of empathy, the idea that Inkpa Duda is forced out of Smithland into the worst winter in at least a century, and then he watches one of his grandchildren die as they make their way up the Little Sioux River to this place of rest, the site of their summer village at Okoboji. And it's just this, you can see a tipping point moment developing as you work through the sources and even in kind of the quantification of some of these other things. It's just incredibly kind of just difficult story all the way around.
Yeah. so much pain. And Gary's book really focuses on the lead up to this event at Spirit Lake and then the aftermath of that as well. But Kevin, I think it's important also to understand some of the other things that were going on in the Midwest at the time, especially with the Dakota and especially in Minnesota. I mean, we really, if we learn our history, we can see this systematic removal of people from their lands, the destruction of their culture, the genocide of indigenous people. The pressure was just so ferocious.
Yeah, you can see, I mean, there's not a lot of options. And the Dakota had a cultural dynamic that allowed for disagreement, allowed for adaptability, and the idea that some of the Dakota went a different direction than Inkpaduta. Inkpaduta chose to largely just passively resist through ignoring treaties that he didn't consent to. Where others signed some of these treaties, especially leading up to the treaties in Minnesota, there was two that took place in 1851, that largely took the Dakota and completely altered their lifestyle and moved them towards what we'd call acculturation on the reservation on the Minnesota River. And that's ultimately going to, we can see the other side of that story. It's going to precipitate the violence that's going to happen in the U.S.-Dakota War in the early 1860s. We can also just see this resistance continuing to build and just very, very difficult when we go through it. But I think through understanding this, this is one of those, I think, opportunities for empathy. I think it's one of those opportunities where we can't really understand our past as Iowans without looking at the difficult things in the same way we can't do that in our day-to-day lives. And this idea that as we seek to better understand who the Dakota were in Iowa or how events unfolded, I really appreciate Gary's book. I think this is going to be a great opportunity for a lot of people to interact with this topic in a really meaningful way. I'm hoping that eventually it'll lead to greater understanding of this complexity and nuance that can help us better understand ourselves as a people here in the state of Iowa.
Gary, have you heard from anybody who is pushing back on this telling of history? I mean, Abby Gardner-Sharp has been a heroine for a lot of Iowans for a very long time. And I don't think that your telling takes anything away from her at all. But this is something that I guess a lot of Iowans feel very close to and proud of her and her history. Have you heard from anybody who's worried about that kind of loss?
Not really. Of course, the book hasn't been out very long, but no, I haven't had any blowback on that at all, not yet, and it won't change my mind. But but yeah, I mean, telling the story, it was a rough time for her. I mean, totally, and her companions that were with her. I mean, they captured Inkpaduta. Took four of them with his band out to South Dakota eventually, and two of them were lost, and two of them survived, but including Abby. But I want to tell the story accurately, but I also want to bring in some edges around it that. Give some reason to the story. You know, I mean, obviously there's no reason for mass, you know, killing people that way, but Inkpaduta his people had definitely felt the same thing from the opposite direction, and that's the thing that up to this point I'd read a few versions of Spirit Lake, and I had never heard much from that point of view.
Yeah.
So I wanted to balance it.
I think you do it very well with empathy and with facts on both sides of the story, Gary. And I think we're at a moment right now where there has been the politicization of our history in so many ways. But it's also, it feels to me like a very exciting time where we are experiencing a much fuller understanding of our history. We have an opportunity to take it from a two-dimensional story into a true history. And Kevin, I mean, what are your thoughts on that as someone who has been doing that?
Go ahead.
I think we don't lose anything when we bring everyone to the table. The idea that we can understand the incredible loss and trauma that Abby Gardner-Sharp lived through while still recognizing the difficult challenges that Inc. Peduta faced. History doesn't lose anything in becoming more complex and more nuanced and better representing all these different experiences. We only just gain a better understanding of what things are happening, a more complete kind of record of the past. And as we seek to kind of further develop all of these different available sources and points of view and some of these other things, this is only going to make it make for a better conversation where everyone is able to better reconcile the past, better able to kind of come together in order to truly understand these events that happened. And I really appreciate that. I think Gary's book is a step in that direction.
Yeah. Well, Gary, thank you so much for making this story so accessible and for telling it in a new way. The book is Moon of the Snowblind by Gary Kelly. It's a graphic novel, text and pictures by Gary Kelly of Cedar Falls. And Kevin Mason, thank you so much, assistant professor of history at Waldorf University in Forest City. He's been researching the history of the Dakota in Iowa and Inc. Peduta in particular. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.